circumstances that it's not against us. How do we know this? For a very, very simple reason. That for at least 95% of the existence of the human beings, etc., there were no states. Now, I know, you can say this is because, well, come on, little bands of hunters and so on, they can manage to get on, they're all interrelated anyway, and so on and so forth. But no, no, that won't do. You see, the big expansion in human population, a truly massive expansion in human population, the most rapid ever, quite largely elaborate. None of them were state societies. No, no states then existed in Europe, existed in Western Asia. Now then, why then do we have everywhere in the world today states? In fact, over the last 50 years or so, states have been proliferating. There are far, far more, you know, than there were in 1945, far, far more than there were in 1914, and so on, and you won't keep arriving. Now, they all have certain characteristics in common. Let's look at the essential characteristics of a state. I'll start with the bourgeois thought, and then go on to that. Bourgeois legal definition, legal textbook is, a state is a body which has a monopoly of the legal use of force within a defined territory. Now, that's not a fundamental definition, but it points to one of the central characteristics of any state. Force, the monopoly, if they can manage it, within their territory, and sometimes outside their territory too. Go to Marx's definition, and it's very similar in its stating Engels' version. He said, a state consists essentially of soldiers, policemen, and their material appendices. To that we have to add something, as a matter of fact, not that Engels didn't know it, but we have to add a bureaucratic hierarchy. Now, the more we discover about states in the past, right, we see they're highly variable in this respect. Some states have managed with a minimal bureaucratic apparatus. But all modern states are characterized by a massive and proliferating bureaucratic hierarchy. It's a hierarchy, it's the thing. By a bureaucracy, I do not mean people sitting in offices with sitting around with, what are they called? VDUs? Various kinds of sophisticated equipment which I don't understand. No, that's a kind of work. What constitutes a bureaucracy is a hierarchy with its grades, with its ranks, with its differentiation of pay, conditions, and even the size of the carpet you're allowed in the office. All this, yeah, it's true, British civil service, you know. It astonished me when I first read this. In the civil service proper, you are entitled, as you, this is the title, the bottom rank, you're entitled as you rise from deputy this to something that, permanent the other, and so on, to a somewhat bigger office, a somewhat bigger and better carpet. They're issued, you see, you have to requisition them from those guys, and even in the higher rank, a certain number of specified pictures. They're reproductions, I have no doubt. But you know, it goes up, what you can get goes up. That's the essence of the thing, a bureaucratic hierarchy. Now then, how does this arise? And from the British Civil Service today, we look back to the development of the first state, which occurred in the Middle East out of North Africa, 5,000 years ago, give or take a bit. The dating is, we have to be a bit elastic, some before, others before. How did they arise? They arose on the basis, first of all, of the existence of population practicing agriculture, including animal breeding and so on and so forth, with a significant social surplus. Now, some of these talks you have to keep going back. Social surplus means this, right? Any workforce, not the modern working class, any kind of workforce, has to continue over a period, more than one generation, have enough to eat and other conventional necessities. Eating is not a conventional necessity, of course. Not only to sustain himself or herself, but also to reproduce the population. Because if you don't reproduce the population, obviously, it's a society with a very, very short existence. Now then, over and above that, all societies beyond the most primitive, I don't want to talk about, have been able to produce a surplus, which is more actually than is necessary to keep the weak workforce alive and reproduce it. Yeah? Comes in with agriculture eventually. It's true. Pre-hunter-gatherer societies can sometimes have a surplus. The game is very plentiful this year, and we keep killing and killing and killing, but actually all we can do is eat it or let it rot. There is no means, basically, of accumulating a surplus which can be used for next year, the year after, and so on and so forth. Now then, these societies, or some of them, under conditions that we have only a fairly minimal knowledge of, it's enough that in certain areas, river valleys, the land annually fertilized by flooding and so on and so forth, the Nile is a classic example, same thing's true, the Tigris, Euphrates area, so on and so forth. Here they discovered that actually the land here is so much richer and you don't have to worry about fertilizers and so on and so forth. You don't have to worry about animal fertilizers, as soon as you knew about them, you probably did. Actually, the soil is renewed annually. And the yield you can get is vastly greater than anything you have seen before. Now, we don't know the name of anything. It's all about the people who first discovered it, but they discovered it. Sensational discovery. Secondly, there are problems with it. Devastating floods. Yes, you want the flood, but you don't want to be washed out entirely. You know, everything go with it. Therefore, again, unknown innovators in pre-class society, not clever people who were specialists in drilling or anything like that, discover that actually you've got to dig channels, you've got to develop an irrigation system. Initially, a very simple one. Now, once this process has started, it requires a much larger degree of social coordination than it's done before. As a matter of fact, the labour input required to develop the irrigation systems along the Nile, remember, with very primitive equipment, they had no metal, they hadn't yet discovered how to extract metal from the source, basically using stone tools, some animals, and back-breaking labour. You actually, enormous input, they developed these elaborate irrigation systems. And inevitably, some people are required to direct the process. Not if it's done in a village or two or three villages, but when the thing is done on a large scale, inevitably, coordination. Now then, how do these people live when they are, or how did they live, when they're engaged in this labour which does not immediately produce any grain or anything else you can eat? Alright? Sort of accumulation. Well, they have to use the existing surplus. The surplus has to be regulated. We can't let her eat my rations. come on, why not? It's not a question of morality. Morality is the name, the word term you use to excuse, you know, to justify the thought. You know. No, the reason is very simple. If I don't get enough to eat, I'll be a useless worker, right? And therefore, the control of the surplus shifts into the hands of useless people who are performing a necessary function. The directional function is a necessary function, but who inevitably develop into a darker, ultimately a class with interests of their own. Now, once this happens, there's another fundamental change. You have development of a class structure, perhaps in a very simple term. Once you've got the class structure, you've got something else. You've got a class struggle. I want more, we want more. You're getting too much, etc., etc. We want more of the produce of our own labour, etc., etc. The most basic, elementary level. Once you've got the development of the class struggle, come on, you've got problems. The thing can be torn apart, can't it? Now, this is from the point of view of the people directing the process. Therefore, we need something else. We need force. Bodies of armed men, as Engels put it, who are divorced from, serving from the productive process, and whose essential purpose is to serve the interests of the people who are directing operations. In short, coercion, coordination, right, gives way gradually to coercion. And so you have the nucleus, the central nucleus, the force in the hands of the controllers who themselves determine what happens to the surplus, or perhaps decide who gets what, right, in every respect. And finally, of course, you have a bureaucracy. Bureaucracy comes right in. You see, it is said that the founder of Marks and Spencer's, well, I say it's said, I read it in a book that was put out by Marks and Spencer's. Company history, you know, whitewashing everything. Nevertheless, it is a very interesting story about the founder of the early days. He came from Bialystok, knowing no English. He was Jewish, you see, being no English. The pogroms were on and so on and so forth. He was shipped from, you know, the sort of railway system they had. They pass you on to a contact here, to a contact there, and so he arrived in London. And in London, looking around, he decided there's too many poor Jews. It would be back in Britain or somewhere like that, you see. I had too much competition, so he went to Leeds. Well, I thought there were some Jews, remember, didn't speak any English. Once he got there, he built up an empire. He started with a pack on his back, tramping the dairy, selling meals of cotton. You know, you could, in those days, actually these prices still grew when I was a kid. They sold at a penny each, but you can buy them at 11 cents paper for a dozen. Yeah? So he went around, fantastic effort and so on. And then he managed to get a stall in Leeds Market. I mustn't take too long, but it's an amusing aspect of the thing because it does relate to the states. You see, he knew about states, he knew about the Tsarist states. He called the state the Cossack. And, you know, what are they there for? They're there to rob you, to beat you up, etc. But you have to have means of dealing with them. And he thought the Leeds City Council were Cossacks, you see. Therefore, you have to get a tame goy. And so he found a man called Spencer. He was a clerk in a warehouse. Knew English, obviously. I could read and write, which, of course, Spencer Marx himself couldn't do in English. And he was to deal with the goy. But you see, if you tell these people too much, they'll take it off you. Therefore, Spencer, the man operating the books, and so, you know, you have to present to inspectors and that, mustn't know what really happened. How is that possible? Because the only one who knows is me, because it's all in my head. He never wrote down. He knew all the purchasing prices, all the sales prices and so on. Right, skip ahead. They did this until the time of the First World War, when actually, large enterprise, I think they had 34 bazaars, as they called them, in different towns, or he had, and nobody but nobody knew what was bought, what was sold and so on, except the founder. And then he had a nervous breakdown, so the family, his family had to depose him. Obviously, you know, one small grain, however big, can't carry all this. Hence, right, that's an illustration of the notion that once you have gone beyond a certain stage, the liberation of the bureaucracy, remembering, mass of the population illiterate, the bureaucracy, originally subordinate, the directors, and the chiefs of the people who use or have the force, right, to get the internal and external defense, and finally, the ideologists. The people who justify the system and say why it is inevitable, why it is desirable, and why you aren't looking up to second, right? They were called priests. These groups fused together to form a distinct ruling class. And every subsequent state, although, as I said earlier, there are marked distinctions between states, has all these features in varying degrees. What does that mean? It means that the state is a feature, an essential feature of a class society. It is not the case that you need a state for some technical, organizational reasons. No, no, you can get on quite well without it, as I would argue, a moment or two. But if you have a class society, you must have a state. If there is a state, it's a class society. Okay, now then, we must look at capitalist states. Forget all the ancient history now. Capitalist state. Capitalist state, in its origin, at least, a bit of simplification, was actually what you might call a minimalist state. You know, the German socialist Marcel coined the term the night watchman state. All it consists of basically are soldiers, policemen, and bureaucrats. Therefore, the bourgeoisie, developing bourgeoisies, rising bourgeoisies in Europe and so on, favoured this. They regarded expenditure on the state as probably, it's a theft from production, from accumulation. They were interested in accumulating capital. They knew they had to have it, but you keep it as small as possible. So that many of the functions that we take for granted today did not exist in 19th century states. Let's see people's direct experience of the state. Right? Well, at a certain age you go to school. People have always gone to school. You have to go to school. Basically, an educational structure imposed by the state. It did not exist in this country before 1870 on a compulsory basis, and in practice not for another 20 years. It wasn't universal. But then, not only do you go to school, you leave, you can't get a job, you've got to go to the, I'm sorry, they call them job centres now, don't they? You've got to go up there as a state operation. You get benefits. Miserable it may be, but you get benefits. I even get a pension from the thing, you know? All the rest of it. In other words, the whole apparatus which affects the lives of ordinary people massively. Now, how do we account for that? Quite clearly, it's not done from the benevolence of the rulers. Well, some folk cast enough to believe that, but I assure you it's not so. No, no. It's a product of the class struggle. You see, the class struggle modifies the character of the state. It doesn't change its essential character, but it adds on a number of functions. You know the story in this country. Old age pensions, what, 1910? No, 1911. Yeah? Before that, no, nothing, right? Why was it done? Period of labour unrest and so on. The then government offered, delivered, a few, initially fairly minimal, reforms to working people. Precisely, in other words, similarly, unemployment benefit on a contributory basis, of course, and only for certain groups of people, but never mind, was introduced at roughly the same period. And since then, there have been periods of expansion and periods of contraction of these services. What does it depend on? It depends on the course of the class struggle. Put it very bluntly, When the voters are scared, they are likely, if they can, to concede all kinds of things within the framework of the system. And then, when they're no longer scared, Thatcherism and so on, right, we chisel away at it again. It's not so easy, of course, to reverse, but nevertheless, that's it. Now, I mention this because if you read The Origins of the Family, Private Property and the State, this aspect, which I hope you do at some stage, is not mentioned. It's an important aspect of present state, and we have to understand it because everyone knows about it. It's not just a secondary thing. But there is something else. The night watchman state of the 19th century could be quite a big state, could have a big army and all the rest of it. Therefore, it had an economic effect in the sense that soldiers have to be fed, clothed, armed, etc., etc., etc. Nevertheless, the ideal, the bourgeois ideal, was the state does not intervene in the economy. Why? Except, of course, if you establish a stable currency and so on and so forth. Right, why not? Because, you know, good old 19th century bourgeois economics revived under Thatcher, and not just Thatcher, you know, around the world in the 1880s. Any state decision, any external decision, external to them, actually produce a worse result. Therefore, hands off, free enterprise, free trade, and so on and so forth. Now, of course, the reality is very far from the ideology, but the economic role of the state in the 20th century, and in particular since the Second World War, has been enormous, absolutely enormous. Therefore, we have to add the two functions I've just talked about. Now, perhaps we should have had this talk first. Tony Rosenberg is giving a talk on the Paris Commune, not the next one, but the one after. What's the time? Someone must have a program. Point is, I'm not going to talk about the Paris Commune, I'm going to talk about the effect it had on Marx. You see, no one is born with fully formed their ideas and so on, and some fortunate people are even as adults able to develop and change their minds. Not many, but some do. Marx was profoundly influenced by the experience of the Paris Commune on what question? On the question of the state. You read the Communist Manifesto, don't talk about smashing the state. Test it for yourself. No, it was the experience of the Communists that convinced Marx. Said, one thing above all, proved by the Communists. This is from the Civil War in France. It is not possible to simply transfer the state machine from one class to another. I'm paraphrasing a bit. It must be smashed. The notion, therefore, that the existing state machinery cannot be used to establish a classless society is repeated a few years later by Marx and the Peace of the Gotha Program and so on and so forth. Well, I mean, that's what Marx said. Is this real? Come on, think of all the functions I have talked about. Some are necessary, some are not necessary. Objectively, in our interest. Is it feasible? Yeah. See, our real difficulty, and I keep coming back to that, is we are ourselves conditioned by our environment, obviously. And by all the things we know about, in states that existed for so long and so on and so forth. Let us take the central thing, the economic direction. Will a socialist economy require more or less planning, etc., direction, etc., than a capitalist one? No, it will almost in certainly require more. But that does not. I think so. I can be proved wrong. Come on. We haven't got there yet. We'll find out. But let us assume it will require more. But that does not imply a hierarchy. The hierarchy exists because the state mirrors the class structure. Right? The permanent undersecretary or deputy, God knows what not, gets a salary and they justify it on these grounds. Well, that's what he could earn in private industry. In a capitalist enterprise. The whole hierarchical structure is based on the existing class structure. It modifies it, but it's based upon it. As a matter of fact, there is no reason at all why a hierarchy in terms of salaries, in terms of size of offices, etc., etc., ought to exist, except to maintain the power of the capitalist class. That, at the end of the day, is what it's for, isn't it? Therefore, however complex the administration, coordination is necessary, cooperation is necessary, direction is necessary, decisions have to be taken. But it doesn't follow that you have to have the hierarchy. Let's go quickly. Same argument applies to economic planning. Let's go quickly to the central question, the most obvious one, about the state force. Lenin wrote a book called State and Revolution, which essentially consists of everything Marx and Engels ever wrote on the question of the state. I mean, it tells us that in the introduction, you pretend it's an original work, but it's loaded. I mean, it's a very convenient book, actually, in many ways, because if you read it, you don't need to read the original, and I suspect that that's what most people do. But he takes up this question of force. He says, we are not utopians. We know that certain forms of behaviour, certain types of behaviour have to be prevented. Certain people have to be restrained. Doesn't that therefore mean that you're back to the policeman, the soldier, and so on and so forth? Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that we'll come to the ultimate stage in a moment, but in any immediately foreseeable future, yes, do we necessary? Do you call? Point is, who has the force? And here we come to something absolutely fundamental, and this is anathema. How the social democrats of every shape or form, right? The force must be diffused through the working class population. That is to say, the workers must be armed. That is to say, the indispensability of a militia system, etc., 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 which also has three points. Now, everyone in the Marxist movement took that for granted. Took it for granted until the First World War. You know, the Second International, good old British Labour Party affiliated and all the rest of it, subscribed to the notion, abolition of standing armies, institute the militia system, Hail Mary, and it was Hail Mary, because it didn't really mean it, you know. Nevertheless, it was the accepted idea. And when you think about it, the astonishing thing is that if anyone can actually think about a classless society in which one stratum has a monopoly of arms force, it is a contradiction in terms, isn't it? So we come to the question of the so-called workers' state. Now, the argument was, and this goes back to Marx, you cannot jump from a class society, developed class society, capitalism, to the free, stateless, classless society of the future at one bound. You can't do it for a number of reasons. Economic development is essentially important, of course, but a whole number of other things. People have to, new generations trained, and so on and so forth. There has to be an intermediate stage. It was Marx who, he didn't actually invent the phrase, but who described this as the dictatorship of the proletariat. Now look, we have to be careful here about words. You see, words shift their meaning or acquire different shades of meaning according to circumstances. By the dictatorship of the proletariat, he did not mean that me, hopefully, dictator of the proletariat, will tell you what to do. He meant that the working class, organized and armed and so on, constituted the core of the state. And that the whole thing, it will be explained in the talk on the Commune, the bureaucratic hierarchy will be abolished. Judges will be elected, subject to re-election, of course, everyone will be elected, subject to the court. A system, a thoroughgoing democratic system, which did not spring afresh, you know, from his own brain in his back room, but was the actual experience of the Paris Commune. Now, that's a work of state. Eventually, Marx and Engels argued, both Lenin following them, that over time, with the expansion of the socialist system, gradually you proceed to reduce inequalities in earnings, not for the dimensions we have now, but certainly in earnings and so on, will possess for a time. Some people have a genuine skilled monopoly. Yes, they do. I mean, most people who claim a skilled monopoly are faking it. I mean, what they've really got is a privileged position in the hierarchy. Not all of them. And some people who have genuine skilled monopolies are highly paid. We have to go on paying them for a time. Until you, you know, in a worker state, until you produce more and more of them. I do not want, I don't want it anyway, but if I have to be cut up for some purpose, I do not want to be cut up by a good socialist plumber, by someone who may be outrageously well paid and so on and so forth, at least be trained to do the job. You know what you're doing. And that sort of skill monopoly cannot be abolished by decree. It can be eroded. You expand the supply and so on and so forth. Therefore, the transitional society, what Marx called the dictatorship of the proletariat, Lenin called the worker state, is a society in which the state functions insofar as they retain a coercive content, and they do, gradually shrink. Not the administrative, not the planning function. Now, all this is utopian, people think. You know why they think it's utopian? Coming back to it again. They've never seen a stateless society. No one in the world today, actually, even the little surviving bands of like reservations, isn't it? Little tiny groups. Actually, they're all dominated by states, still within the territory of states. And at the end of the day, you know, they disappear. No, nobody actually sees. But we have other experiences which should tell us something. Actually, social cooperation, not based on coercion, is very widespread in almost all capitalist societies. I mean, if you're interested in pigeons, they will be certainly the week. Darts, or what have you, then people form societies. Nobody tells them. Nobody pays them to. On the contrary, they pay to keep the damn thing going. They elect their officials, they get rid of them if they don't like them, and so on. No, no, come on, society's riddled with it. Riddled is the wrong word. Full of some examples of cooperation, which can involve quite complicated operations. We are conditioned to think that there must be a boss, there must be foremen, they must tell you what to do, and there must be a copper there with a new extensible baton to knock you down if you do not conform. Well, I said it's by way of an imagination. But it must, of course. Yeah. I must do it quickly. I must, of course, take up the obvious, accept the obvious argument. You talk about worker state. Look at Russia. And not just Russia. All proliferation of them, China, etc., etc., etc. That's what actually happened, isn't it? It's not the case it was like the Paris Commune and it got freer, and the armed force resided in the hands of the workers, election and regular re-election of officials, subject to the right of recall, and outside the election, you know, we want rid of him, we have another election. Nobody. There's no election. But Joe Stalin, wasn't there? You know? And then you look at the, I talk about bureaucratic hierarchy. My God! I mean, they are characteristics of every modern state, but there has never been human history a more monstrous, elaborate, and brutalized bureaucracy than existed in the USSR. And I'm using the USSR as the, to stand for all the others. How did this happen? Well, now, this is the message. No doubt people have discussions there and so on and so forth. I mention it here to say this. You cannot jump over your head in economic terms. That is to say, we make our own history, but not under conditions of our own choosing, as Marx put it. In other words, we are subject to some constraints which cannot be removed by an act of will, however powerful. And that comes economic development. See, the economic basis for a worker state, a transition to a free society, did not exist in Russia. Its isolation, the failure of the revolution spread into Europe, where the basis did exist, does exist, means that inevitably, in one way or another, Marx said, all the old crap again. Right? And he hadn't seen the USSR, but he made the point in advance. Of course it's true. This one, of course, familiar enough to the leaders of people who, Bolshevik Party and so on, who made the Russian Revolution. They thought that the old crap, the real danger of the old crap, was actually white armies, penetration by capitalist concerns, and so on and so forth. Actually, it took a different form. It took a different form, but its content was essentially similar. The only other thing I want to say about that is that there are people who go around talking about worker states, deformed worker states, deformed, degenerated, etc., etc., etc. Now, the notion of a deformed worker state, the term deformed was first used, was Lenin, speaking, paradoxically enough, against Trotsky in an argument about whether or not you needed independent trade unions independent of the state. Trotsky thought you didn't. Come on, we've got a worker state, what about unions for? Lenin argued, yes, we have a worker state, but it is a worker state subject to bureaucratic deformations. And moreover, a worker state in a country where the working class is a smallish minority of the population. Therefore, yes, the working class needs unions to defend itself against its own state. Now, that's an unhappy, this is 1920, an unhappy situation to get into, yes? But nevertheless, you can see the point. You can have, in 1920, a regime which bureaucratic deformations are already there. The shrinking size of the working class, low level of output, whole number of things which you must have heard talked about before. You can still call it a win. Because at the end of the day, working class did have the possibility, under economic revival conditions and so on, of eliminating the deformation. Once, however, you have a developed class structure and a developed bureaucracy, it is nonsense to talk about the worker state. Now, the only reason I bring this up is, I expect there's one of them in the audience, we'll get this sort of argument again. Come on, comrades, it's bullshit. Let's think, we're talking about self-emancipation of the working class. The working class running society, collectively, democratically, taking decisions and so on and so forth. The notion of a worker state is merely an acceptance of the fact that for a shorter or longer transitional period, some elements of coercion, some antisocial elements have to be restrained, apart from the other side, they have to be destroyed, and so on. And a whole number of other things. But the whole point is that this is a transition to a classless, stateless society. Now, once you have societies which are clearly an obstacle to the development of a classless, stateless, free society, whatever you want to call them pink elephants, in no conceivable sense are they worker states. Finally, comrades, I'll finish with Engels. And again, it's a question of the imagination. Difficult for us to accept the reality. It's difficult for us to accept, as a matter of fact, the reality of the functions of the state under modern capitalism. Even more difficult for us to imagine how society can be run collectively by the actual producers, i.e. the working class. Engels finishes up his book on the origins of the family, crime, property, and the state. With a splendid paragraph, which I'm not going to read, because I've forgotten most of it, but I've got the last sentence, saying the transition is difficult to imagine. Nevertheless, it's going to happen. Nevertheless, this is the course of history. That's what the common ruin of the contending classes. Either we get a socialist future, a classless and therefore faithless society, or we go back to barbarism. And when we've got it, he says, and this is a book, so I remember it very clearly, the state will survive as a museum exhibit along with the Bronze Axe.